Welcome back, everybody, to the Brexit podcast. It's Tim hosting today, and we're continuing our weekly news Brexit news format, I should say. It's been going into the third week been doing it, so I think we can still claim it is somewhat new. In true podcasting fashion, I'm sat here sans internet. And I've also just hobbled around London Marathon earlier today, so I'm perhaps not going to be at the top of my game. But the good thing is that's why we have got Steph Farnsworth back on the show. Steph joined us a few weeks ago now to talk about the new youth magazine stand-up that she's editor of, and she was very eloquently put over many really good points about Brexit, and the show's been hugely listened to. It's in our top five so far. So Steph has very kindly agreed to join us to go through her top 5 points of the week's Brexit news. I guess the first thing I should say is, how the heck are you, Steph?
I'm very good, thank you. Very exhausted. Don't let anyone tell you that journalism is easy, because it most definitely isn't when you're running your own magazine. But
anybody who launches it at a magazine in 2017 has my utmost respect.
Well, you know, Theresa May really made life easier by calling the election for us and changed our entire schedule. So.
Yeah, let's talk about that a bit later on, because that's quite exciting. I mean, the whole point of the magazine is to try and engage youth into politics. So you couldn't have had a real testing mark there straight away, haven't you, with June the 8th?
Oh, definitely.
Okay, let's pick up on that at the end. Let's go into Brexit news. Hit me with your first point.
So I think that probably the biggest story, or perhaps non-story, as it's not being covered that much by mainstream media, is the fact that May's had a few key aides resigning, most notably the press secretary and the director of communications. So normally this would be a pretty big story, you know.
Now this is Lizzie Loudon and Katie Perrier, isn't
Perrier.
It?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And normally it would be pretty big news, you know, two aides resigning just as a general election's coming up. And they are in charge pretty much of delivering May's message for the future of Britain. But it's not really been met with that much fanfare. I know that the Mirror covered it, and I think the Huffington Post, but that was pretty much it. I think the media's still quite focused on Corbyn and any mistakes Labour are making at the minute. So it's given, with a couple of other parties, a free pass perhaps.
Is this another example then of the mainstream media pushing their own agenda? Because had this been a couple of Corbyn's aides resigning, then would the pro May, pro Tory press have been getting the hook straight into that?
I mean, I definitely think that at least if it isn't part of their agenda, then they've seriously dropped the ball by not covering this as much, because it's quite interesting, because Theresa May could have spun this quite early on as something that isn't a big deal, because, you know, she maybe took on the aides when it was a transitional government through Brexit, but now she wants new people because she's calling an election and it's for a steadfast government. She could have spun it very positively, actually. It didn't have to be a disaster. But she didn't even mention it, and it's been very hushed up. And that suggests that the media wasn't ever really going to pay attention to it, that Theresa May didn't think there was anything that was worth spinning. You know, you only have a crisis in politics if anyone ever notices, and the media didn't notice.
Do we know why they've left? Lizzie Loudon was working on the Leave campaign under Ian Duncan Smith, wasn't she? So given we're heading for Brexit, why would she leave now?
Well, that's another question. It's been very vague. It's been very much, I think Loudon's was that she wanted to pursue something else. There was a change of direction. They're very vague, moving on to other things. But there's been no concrete issue. And there has been rumours about May's style of leadership. Is she a bit controlling? She was also, at one point, a Remain supporter. So maybe there was a conflict there. We don't really know. And that's kind of the point of the story. Nobody knows what's going on, because the media isn't scrutinising it perhaps as much as they should be.
Yeah, you're right. There's probably more to this than meets the eye. It would be good. We should keep our eyes on this one, shouldn't we? Fiona Hill and Nick Timothy, do we know too much about them? But they're the people who've got to pick up the ball from here, haven't they?
Yeah, I don't actually think it'll be too difficult a time for them. you know, Theresa May has been very much in Tory heartlands campaigning right now. It's quite easy for them to get on message if May sticks to that for the next week or so and to really catch up with everything and deliver a coherent message. The Tories are actually in a bit of an advantage in terms of campaign because nobody knows what Brexit means because the Tories haven't really revealed anything, and in uncertain times people want stability, and so the Tories can kind of say, we're going to give you the stability, follow us, trust in us, but they've not actually revealed anything new, whereas everyone else has to deliver a new policy plan.
Yes, and obviously I suppose that the opposition, there's no clear opposition at the moment anyway, so I guess that's why they called the election in the first place.
Yeah, well, it worked out well for them.
The other thing is, just on May, she obviously refused a few days ago to talk, to rule out tax rises or commit to them, likewise with Corbyn. Do you feel that's a good strategy, or do you think in her current position she should just be a bit more transparent with what they want to do?
At the minute, it's quite helpful to not be as transparent, to be honest, because she is keeping a tight grip on everything and nobody knows what is going on. But at the same time, the narrative that is then being spun is that we have to trust Theresa May because she's the only one who actually knows what's going on. It is quite a useful tactic for her to create kind of chaos, and particularly with the U-turns in a strange way. As much as there have been U-turns and that she's buckled under pressure and there's been certain other factors, the major narrative that's been spun has largely been supportive of May. It's that she's holding the cards, that she's led, and even when she's U-turned, it's been because of either Tory pressure or because that's what she's wanted to do. Corbyn hasn't really featured in that narrative in the media too much, regardless of whether he should be actually be or not. So I do think that whether by luck or by calculation, she's playing quite a calculated strategy.
Now, you mentioned Corbyn there, and I think your second news point of the week actually addresses the Labour leader, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, Corbyn has had a good week in terms of campaigning. He's answered questions. He's been very forthright. There's been some new policy announcements today. It was just the bank holiday announcements that he wants some more. But still, on the first couple of days of campaigning, there was a bit of mixed messages, particularly with McDonnell and would there be a second referendum or would there not be. Now, it was the first main campaign event and should really have been some sort of answer to that. And there was a bit of dithering about, and then Corbyn finally ruled out that there wouldn't be, which still seems to contradict with the shadow chancellor. And, you know, Brexit is always going to be one of the top priorities for people. Even if people are sick to death of Brexit, it's going to impact our welfare state, it's going to impact on the NHS, it's going to impact on students and foreign students. It's going to be a major issue, and you would think that by now. I know that the election caught people off guard, but on the question of the second referendum, particularly when Tim Farron for weeks has been quite hard on this answer, it was just surprising that Labour didn't already have a coherent message straight away of, no, we won't have a second referendum, that's not our policy. So it was just a bit surprising for the first couple of days, and it was a blunder that they didn't need to make because they have had some very strong policy announcements lately that have been received well. So it was just a bit of a case of, oh, Labour, can you please get your act together just on the small stuff and try and challenge a bit more in that sense.
Yeah, it does seem a bit confusing because I guess if there was a seismic shock and the Tories didn't hold, then Labour's real only route in is some kind of pact with Liberals, and you'd have thought going to pushing for a second referendum and perhaps appeasing the largely disaffected 48%, I suppose. And they would be if the Tories, you know, there was a shock and people didn't come out to vote for the Tories, that would be very clear that Brexit was still huge on people's agenda and those who wanted to remain.
Yeah, I think the opposition are in quite uncharted waters because not a lot of people trust the Liberal Democrats after 2010, so they don't particularly want to vote for Liberal Democrats, even though they're anti-Brexit. Corbyn's in a very difficult position because a lot of his parties is ardently Remain, and a lot of people supported Leave within Labour. So Labour are completely split, and they're kind of in no man's land. And damned if they do, damned if they don't, because if they support the second referendum, the Leavers are going to be absolutely furious. But if they don't, then Remain are going to feel betrayed. So I really don't envy Corbyn's job right now of what he's got to do. But at the same time, whatever message he goes with, whether it is a second referendum, whether it's not, whether he is for Brexit, whether it's not, he's got to come up with that policy and he has to stick to it. And he's got to be coherent about his message, because voters don't really know what Labour would do on Brexit yet.
Yeah, I take your point. I was just looking at Corbyn as well. I guess it's not just the party that split. If we look at Corbyn's Eurosceptic past, that's going to rear its head, isn't it? You know, he voted for us to not join the membership of the EU in 75. He voted against the Maastricht Treaty in 93. He does have a Eurosceptic past, no matter what
definitely
he feels now.
Yeah, and the Liberal Democrats, I mean, they can barely get through a tweet these days without saying, "Oh, well, Corbyn, who did you vote for Leave, or did you really support him?" It is something that has followed him around and has really kind of damaged him going into any Brexit debate and around Article 50, because there's a lot of people on the left who think, but did Corbyn really support us? Is he really listening to the 48%, or is this secretly what he wanted all along? And that kind of thing is quite small, but it is insidious and it can damage trust, particularly when Corbyn hasn't had a very consistent message on this.
Yep, sounds like he needs to get his act together. You mentioned the lack of trust with the Liberal Democrats. One of those reasons, I think, is pertinent to your next point, point three,
Uni fees. Uni fees, I mean, for young people, that's been the big talking point since 2010. And Theresa May, actually, this week was doing a campaign event in her own constituency of Maidenhead. And she was asked very candidly about student fees and whether it made university more accessible. And just in the last year, we've actually seen applications for university go down for the first time. And she kind of brushed it off, didn't answer, and actually angered students quite a lot by talking about other things such as employment or apprenticeships. Now,
are you saying she simply didn't answer the question?
Yeah, which, as shocking as that is to hear about a politician. But no, she did not.
Okay, sorry, I cut across you, please.
And it's just something that students and young people have been carrying around for quite a few years and would like an answer as to this policy and what the future is going to be, because university students in the UK are paying some of the highest fees, but at the end of it, a lot of them aren't getting graduate jobs. So we're paying $9,000 for uni and then coming out of it and getting into very low-paying jobs. And it is kind of epitomising the fact that the government doesn't seem to have a very coherent policy or any policy whatsoever with young people and how to support employment or support education or what to do about debt or living standards. And Theresa May is just not coming up with anything right now. And it left students at the event quite disheartened, and there was a lot of anger on social media afterwards. But after this long, you would think that politicians would maybe start paying attention to the younger voters a bit more.
Just on the cost of going to university, and I hope you can give me a bit background on this, and my interest rates are going up on student loans, aren't they, as well?
Yeah, there's a lot of uncertainty as well because of privatisation of student loans. Part of the problem is that nobody's really taken it governmental level very seriously, because unless you're earning a certain amount, you're not going to be paying back your loans. So a lot of people say, well, if you don't get the jobs in the first place or you get low-paying jobs, it's not going to be an issue anyways. But anyone will tell you who's got debt that if you're carrying around a burden of debt, which can be in the tens of thousands of pounds, sometimes even £20,000, it is going to haunt you, and you are probably going to have to start paying it off at some point. It's going to affect everything. So when you get a mortgage, how much you're paying off, whether you even can get a mortgage, it's going to really affect people's finances in the future. And there's a lot of complaints that young people aren't investing in their futures and in starting families and buying homes, but there is no way for us to do that, really. We don't have any kind of mechanisms in place to help us, to give us the opportunities to build up the capital to be able to do that.
Yeah, you that does raise an interesting point about how it haunts students. I guess also that just their mental well-being is probably going to be, well, it will be affected if you have all of that debt hanging over you all the time.
Definitely. Millennials are far more likely now to be diagnosed with a mental health condition than previous generations. Students as well, around one or four of them are suffering from stress and anxiety. There is a huge burden being placed on younger people that isn't really being addressed. And this also is a good time to mention that mental health services have been cut in recent years. So more young people than ever have been diagnosed with mental health conditions. There's even less support available than there was before.
Although May did make a pledge to put that higher up in the agenda.
Well, so did the Liberal Democrats, but when they were in government, it cut by around 8%, so
don't
we'll see what happens. Yes, well, I always like to judge a manifesto the next 5 years after when they've got to make the next one, so.
Thanks, Seth. Let's move on to point four.
A bit of international news with Trump. It could actually be dominating the news for the next week. Will the US government shut down? Of course it did in 2013. Basically, for anyone who doesn't know, the US government has to agree to spending and the debt ceiling, and if they don't come to agreement, that's Congress and the White House, the government will effectively shut down. And it is always a bit of a mess, and it's kind of, it's a last-ditch card usually by either the majority Congress or by the White House to kind of force a deal through that they want. And Trump is very adamant that he doesn't want to pay for Obamacare and that he wants his wall. And he can't get anything he wants. He can't get rid of Obamacare without Democrat support in Congress or the Senate. And so his kind of feeling is, well, if I shut down the government, the Democrats will not be able to stand the pressure from the constituents who will be furious by a government shutdown, and they'll be more likely to do a deal to get rid of healthcare. It's an incredibly cynical way to go about politics, and it's actually what gives politics a bad name and shows just how reckless Trump can be. But whether it happens or not is a big question, and that's kind of the thing with Trump. He's so unpredictable. Nobody knows whether he really will go to the very worst situation or whether he will actually scale back on his words, because he tends to do a bit of both. You know, he'll use very harsh tweets and then the next week we'll be doing a business deal with a person he's just been tweeting about, or he'll be sending warships off to North Korea. So we don't really know what's going to happen.
What's the time scale on this?
Basically, the government shutdown, there is effectively, it can go on pretty much indefinitely until the government runs out of money. So I think it lasted about 2 weeks in 2013, and that was one of the longest. So it could be a story that drags on for a while.
And do you think it's more important for Trump to shut down Obamacare or build his wall?
I think probably the wall, because that's the one that gets the most headlines and that's what he cares about the most. And it's also probably the most doable in a strange way, because the Republicans are going to have to come up with a whole new solution for Obamacare. There's rumours that they have one, but they're going to have to get it passed by Congress. They're going to have to add all the different amendments to it. They're going to have to work with insurance companies. It's going to be an incredibly complex thing. And for Trump, I actually think it's easier for him to just go, let's build a wall, than it is for him to sit through even one meeting on healthcare. But we'll see.
Now, in terms of Brexit, we obviously want our metaphorical walls, if there are too many, to come down between Britain and the US so we can strike better trade deals as we head out of the European Union. This sounds like Trump's not shy of playing hardball to get what he wants.
Yeah, which I'm sure, or at least I would hope, would have been on May's mind in the first place. I mean, May has kind of suggested that she would sell off part of our NHS in part of an American trade deal, which is a bit worrying, but it might not actually be a risk, because Trump sort of indicated that he would prefer a deal with the EU first, which from Trump's position you can actually understand, because they would have 27 member states, whereas England, you know, is all of the UKIP, to say we're just a small island. So he's not really going to want to deal with us, well, at least not first. So there is a bit of unpredictability, but how realistic a trade deal ever was to come quickly with America. I think that was always doubtful, and it was always a harder task than I think the lead campaign ever anticipated.
Okay, so slightly worrying times on that side of the pond. And I think your final point you wanted to address takes us slightly east.
Yeah, I mean, Russia has been in the news almost as much as Trump has. And there's a running theme, I think, of just how willing leaders are to stand up to the different leaders across the world. And Theresa May was very reluctant to really criticise Trump for the wall or any comment he's made. But there's also been a complete silence on Russia. There's been allegations that they potentially interfered in the Brexit vote. We know of their fake news, but now, worryingly, there's been very little that's been said from our government, apart from perhaps Boris Johnson, on what is going on in Chechnya. Gay bisexual men are being rounded up. There's horrific accounts of torture. They're particularly targeting young men as well, it has to be said, young people who aren't comfortable with their sexuality, who may not be out, who may be more likely to deceive and kidnap. At least three men so far have ended up dead. There's been reports of a concentration-style camp. And the world is quite silent. We've always said that if concentration camps came back, we would say, never again, let's stand up for this. But we haven't really. Our own priorities have taken over. And everyone's scared and doesn't particularly know what to do or how to go about it in Putin, in particular because we know how close his control is over Chechnya. It kind of feels, from a human rights activist perspective, that Putin is using this Chechnya as a little bit of a tester for what can come. He can get away with human rights abuses here. He may well expand them. So it is a worrying time, and so far, the West hasn't really done anything to say that Putin won't be able to just push forward with his own anti-LGBT agenda.
Where does this anti-LGBT agenda come from, Steph? What's the background to the situation in Chechnya? Who's out there reporting? Can we corroborate the reports? And also who is doing the persecution?
Yeah, so Russia out and quite a few activists on the ground, including from Human Rights Watch, have verified the account. The New York Times is also reporting extensively on it. Chechnya is a Muslim majority country, but at the same time, it's also very much under the influence of wider Russian regions and Putin and the Kremlin. And since, 2010, 2011, Russia's really stepped up on its anti-LGBT platform. It has banned propaganda. There have been very well-known LGBT activists who have been found up dead. There are many countless videos online of LGBT people being kidnapped by vigilante gangs and tortured. And Putin has profited on this in terms of imagery, and he has sought to as well. He's been very much, he's not particularly religious, but he likes to use the church to emphasise the Russian Orthodoxy, to emphasise his power and to emphasise his masculinity and to tap into conservatives. Russia's actually had a pretty torrid time with its economy and is quite stagnant. And on times such as a poor economy, then people tend to look for someone else to blame, which has helped a rising anti-LGBT sentiment. And Chechnya has really been a nice test, in a way, for Putin and his toxic masculinity propaganda to really try and hit at LGBT people. And so he sees this as a real win for him to really test how is the world going to react, what can we do? And then the big fear is that he's going to scale this to wider Russia and that his attacks on LGBT people are going to increase. I mean, within this year, we've seen the Duma pass legislation which has decriminalised domestic violence because it fits with Putin's image and Russia's image of clinging on to masculinity because they want to reject Western ideals of liberalism, or at least what they say is Western ideals. And this has created a really dangerous environment for women, for LGBT people, for marginalised people generally across Russia. And Chechnya is really a pressure cooker for that right now, of all of this hatred kind of exploding and as people are now trying to rush out of the country, trying to claim asylum elsewhere, and there are fears that this is just really the first step and that this was used as a trial by Putin.
Does you said it was a predominantly Muslim country. Does Muslim extremism play into this as well, or is it more Putin led?
I think it's more. I always think in these situations, it's more about the leader and about the people themselves than it is about any religion. Yes, some people will use the Quran to say that it condemns homosexuality, but if you look across Africa, and if we exported in places like Jamaica, we exported Christianity, and there's still very oppressive anti-LGBT laws, particularly in places like Nigeria and Uganda, that came from us and came from Christianity. And Christianity was actually thousands of years ago exported here, and we were very, Rome, Greece in particular, and Italy were very liberal with sexuality and relationships, and then Christianity came here and then became much more oppressive. I don't really think religion is to blame. I think that's always used as a cover. I think it's the people, and it's often the politics of the region going on, and it's about the economy and people needing someone to blame for when things aren't going right for them, and it's a whole host of historical factors. But there is a danger with the media that they start to say Muslims are LGBT phobic, or that they're somehow dangerous to LGBT people. Well, we know that's generally not the case, and no more so than it is with Christianity. So I do think the media has to be careful with that, but at the same time, acknowledge what is going on with Chechnya. We cannot turn a blind eye to it. We have to start putting pressure on for more intervention in terms of humanitarian support, in terms of getting people out, because as much as we may condemn Chechnya, the Home Office has an appalling record of deporting LGBT people. We cannot condemn Chechnya while deporting LGBT people to dangerous countries.
With the onset of Brexit, if we just look at this as a case in point, do you think it will be more difficult for sections all around the world that are being persecuted to seek asylum over in Britain? Or do you think there'll always be a place for proper asylum seekers to come here?
I think
that's a big question, I think.
It is.
For a Sunday night.
I think it's one of the most important questions actually from Brexit, because while Brexit and freedom of movement shouldn't actually have any bearing on asylum seekers, we have seen a rising anti-migrant sentiment, and the government, as much as they often like to say that they will enshrine human rights, the government does tend to bow to pressure when it comes to asylum seekers. We've seen LGBT deportations which have just been handled so badly, where people in the past have been asked to submit video evidence to prove that they're gay, that people who were bisexual are just viewed by judges as people who were deceptive and are just saying that they are bisexual to try and claim asylum. We don't have a great culture in this country anyway of supporting asylum seekers, and that goes all the way back to when Jewish people were coming here trying to flee the Nazis, and we didn't particularly embrace them or offer solace or offer support, and we haven't really learnt many lessons. And there's a real danger that with Brexit, that if the government bows to anti-migrant sentiment, that there's going to be a lot of people turned away who should be given help, and a lot of people whose lives could be at risk from that.
And what would you say to someone who says that we've just got enough problems in Britain to deal with, and we can't be going out and helping everyone else in the world, and you know, they might be potentially meddling in other people's affairs?
Well, I'd say that we're one of the largest economies in the world, so the suggestion we can't help a few more people isn't really accurate. And we all live in one world. There might be one day that we need help for something, and we would certainly want it to be given to us. And you know, at the end of the day, it also helps foster democracy and good relations by giving people support, by giving trade deals, by giving people asylum, by working as though we are one world instead of just one isolationist nation. We encourage conversations and dialogue around human rights. We build a pride in our country. We build loyalty to our country. We build a respect to our country. It's what helps make Britain great, helping other people never is a drain on our society. It's as beneficial for us as it is for anyone else. And so even if people want to be incredibly selfish about who we help and the humanitarian and equality arguments aren't enough, well, it actually helps us to help other people as well.
Thanks, Steph. That would have been a great point to leave it. But I also just want to ask you about, with the election coming up on June the 8th, what are the plans for Stand Up? And this is a big test, is can you get the youngsters engaged in the political process? So have you got some news?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's been absolutely fantastic, really, in a twisted way, because I don't think any of us have slept very much since May's announcement. But we're going to be doing events. We've got one on May the 9th where we're holding a talk about how to build an inclusive media when talking about politics and societal issues. We're going to be out doing a lot more videos and trying to get people engaged with young people engaged with politics. There's going to be a lot of election coverage and coverage on the night as well. We're potentially looking at holding events just debate about young people's issues and what's important to them. So there's a lot going on still.
Now you're based in the northeast, aren't you? Because you're in Sunderland. So is a lot of the events going to be focused around the northeast area?
At the minute, yes, but we are looking to potentially expand on that. There's other organisations that we're going to be looking to work with in the next couple of weeks. Hopefully we'll be able to announce more about that on Twitter coming up. So we are looking to connect with people around the country. Even if we can't travel, you know, there's a way of social media and videos now. We can absolutely do things around the country. We really want to connect with people, and we have to be very fluid and very rapid and ready to respond to that. So something that we're really looking forward to. And our online presence as well has shown that this has been an effective method, because in a few days, we've just picked up another few hundred followers and we've smashed our 2K target. So we're hoping to get that up by 3K in the next couple of weeks.
Okay, and if we can help you a bit with that, what's the Twitter handle?
StandUpMag_.
Steph, really appreciate you taking time out to join us for this week's Brexit News Review and picking up on some really interesting points.
We'd love to be back.
And we'd love to have you back on the show soon.
That would be great. Thank you so much. It was lovely to talk to you.
Thanks for joining us, everybody, for today's show. I hope you enjoyed Steph's take on the weekly Brexit news. You can catch up with All Things Brexit podcast on all social media accounts, Twitter, Facebook, and the like. And please give us your feedback. The show is produced by Tim Hemming, Jennifer Hahn, and Warren Pohl, with our theme song by... oh, my God, I've forgotten his name. Mr. McLeod. Until next time, thanks for listening.